This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a new study shows that Black and brown preschoolers are being pumped into the school-to-prison pipeline before they even get to kindergarten. And Newark, New Jersey is about to get a police review board. But the question is, does it have the power to rein in the cops?
But first, outrage continues to build in Richland County, South Carolina, where a white policeman was caught on video manhandling a Black female high school student. Ifeo Wangaza is a people's lawyer and director of the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination in Greenville, South Carolina. She's part of a coalition of citizens and parents that have launched a series of actions against in-school violence, especially against Black girls.
There is a very strong response in the Black community of outrage and disbelief. First of all, that a Black male teacher, knowing the reputation of the in-school cop, would turn to such a person to address the needs of a Black child. A young woman who is a girl, 16 years old, who not only is in dire social straits, I mean, her mother just passed. She is a ward of the state in foster care. She is a special needs child, and his only resort in a room full of cell phones was to insist that she give up her cell phone, which under her circumstances is often instructed to not give up your cell phone, that it is a lifeline. It is the way of staying in touch with your caseworker, staying in touch with your foster parents, staying in touch with the support system necessary for survival. So that's the first thing, and that's created a great deal of ambivalence because on one hand, we've got the race identity and protecting the Black male at the expense of the rest of the world, especially Black children. And at the same time, the expectation that as a professional purportedly committed to the education and well-being of children generally, Black children in particular, that he would have had some other tools in his tool bag to address such a situation where there was no threat to anyone at all. The next thing, of course, is that Columbia is a military town, as is much of the South, and South Carolina in particular is the legacy of Strom Thurmond. So right down the road, you have Fort Jackson, and then not far from that, you have the Citadel and the military schools and academies and factories that support the military. So there is a real also sympathy for the cop who brutalized this kid. And surprisingly, Black people are actually saying that she got what she deserved in that she did not, quote unquote, comply with his orders. So the response is a very mixed response. At the same time, I would say on the other side of that very same coin is an equally strong pushback saying this is not yet a formal police state and we need to be teaching our children that they must not adjust to injustice. And therefore, she had no obligation and no child has an obligation or adult for that matter to simply do what a cop says do because that person has a badge and a gun. And we know what the consequences of that can be. But you know also that the outcome that we've been through this before, and as Martin Luther King said, if you haven't found anything for which you're willing to die, then you are not fit to live. So that's pretty much the position that a lot of other people are beginning to take.
And you're part of that response. What are some of the demands of this coalition of concerned parents and citizens?
The first demand is the dismissal of all charges against the victim, whose name is Shakur, and her classmate, Nia Kenny. We're also demanding that the teacher, the disciplinary administrator or assistant principal for discipline, and the principal himself be terminated. That principal has allowed that cop to maintain a reign of terror in that school and abuse students for years. It is obviously necessary that all of them be relieved. That school is predominantly Black, with the exception of the teacher. The others involved are white males who have not only abused this girl, but other girls. And in fact, it's reported that he actually slammed a pregnant parent onto the hood of a car. And there are lawsuits pending against him for use of excessive force. So all of the people who've allowed this reign of terror and this unhealthy, violative atmosphere to exist need to be fired. Ben Fields needs to not only be fired, but he needs to be criminally charged for assault and the whole range of charges that go along with the abuse of a minor. We want cops out of all schools and replaced with counselors. The repeal of zero tolerance laws, rules, and regulations, demand that restorative justice and dispute resolution training be instituted for all student, staff, and professional support. There is the support of a national student walkout, which is on Monday. However, we expect a rolling walkout, and we expect the need for other kinds of support, lawyers, bail money, as students begin to more effectively organize themselves. We will be organizing people, movement, assemblies locally and throughout the state of South Carolina, and we urge others to do the same thing across the country to build the Dignity in Schools movement to get cops out of schools. The call is culturally competent counselors in, cops out. That is the ultimate demand.
We have read that under the guise of a zero tolerance policy, students in that particular district, 40% of them are likely to be suspended from school in any given year. And frankly, I'd never heard of figures so high.
Suspension, expulsion is the deintegration plan across the country, but with vengeance in South Carolina, where you have a reconstruction, actually, constitutional obligation to provide public education. That was put in by Black Reconstruction legislators. They have done everything conceivable to have it removed from the Constitution and to ultimately render it ineffective as it relates to African children. In fact, in the state of South Carolina, education of African children, Black literacy, is still against the law.
So you're saying that this police occupation policy under the guise of zero tolerance is actually a response to school desegregation?
That's correct. That is absolutely correct. When the schools were initially desegregated, white women quit their jobs and came to school and were volunteer teachers' aides so that they could watch Black teachers dealing with white kids. Eventually, that became a paid position because it was unsustainable as a voluntary position. And of course, with the charter school movement, the Christian academies have just taken off like wildfire because it is a part of the long-standing resegregation agenda that has never gone away.
And the high expulsion and suspension rates are to winnow down the percentage of Black students in integrated schools.
Precisely. That is absolutely correct. So public education is, in this country, is about to go by the boards between the charter schools and the suspension expulsion. Because the other thing is, I mean, when you look, there's alarming new studies that show Black preschoolers being suspended and expelled from school. And we know that the prison bed count is based on whether or not a child can or cannot read on grade level by third grade. So in the state of South Carolina, as across the South specifically, the number of prison beds are based on the expulsions and the suspensions. And once a child is suspended from school as a preschooler, then he or she is four times more likely to drop out of school. And the further along in the process that it occurs, the chances of dropping out or being pushed out more accurately is exponentially increased. So if the continued rationalization that Black schools are underused is going to justify closing Black schools, then there will be no schools for our children to attend.
So all of this has to be seen as parts of a whole. Zero tolerance, police in the public schools, the charterization of schools, and the degrading of public education as an institution.
Absolutely. And to do anything less than that is to not be paying attention. I would urge people to take a look at the publications for the African American Policy Forum. They have two wonderful reports on police brutality and Black women and girls, and especially the one on girls. The fact of the matter is that Black girls are more frequently and severely punished in public school than any other group, even Black males. Black girls are six times more likely to be punished, to be suspended or expelled than white males, as compared with three times for Black males. So we're at a crisis stage as it relates to Black girls in public schools. And that means that we as a people are at a crisis, because it is through the woman that the nation is educated and lifted.
That was Ethiel Wangaza of the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination in Greenville, South Carolina.
The school-to-prison pipeline starts before Black and brown students even set foot in kindergarten, according to a new study by the Center for American Progress and the National Black Child Development Institute. Researcher Mariam Adamu says the study shows that lasting harm is inflicted on Black and brown children in preschool, where they suffer disproportionate suspensions and expulsions.
One of the reasons why we wanted to put this piece out is whenever people hear school-to-prison pipeline, I think what a lot of people imagine are high schoolers or kids who are sort of at the end of their K-12 educational career. And something that we wanted people to really understand is this is something that happens throughout, particularly children of color, and like very, very particularly for Black children. It's something that happens throughout the educational career. And even before we sort of imagine the school-to-prison pipeline, it happens in those early 3, 4, and 5 years. And so whenever we talk about this and we talk about ways to disrupt the pipeline, eliminate the pipeline, the beginning of the conversation is in preschool. And so we really wanted to make sure that people understood the school-to-prison pipeline to be something a little bit more broad than I think is what is traditionally thought of.
Many people think that they're familiar with the problems that beset inner city schools and have for so long beset those schools. But preschools are rather new in terms of education in this society, and yet they seem to be reproducing the same problems that we see in conventional K through 12 education.
I think the thing that we want preschool and early childhood education is we're at a point where we are working towards expanding it nationwide. We're working towards a goal of universal preschool and something that we have to think of. And I think Janine Backey of Children's Defense Fund, I think, said as we're looking to expand this, it's really an opportunity to get some things right that perhaps we've messed up in the past. And a really good example of that is our school discipline policies. And particularly because they're so developmentally inappropriate for kids at this age, there's like a really important case to be made that if there's any time at which to get these things right and to support kids, it's really in this 0 to 5 stage where their brains are developing, where it's really, really important to provide the type of support, adult support, sort of support their learning process and their connection to schools and their connection to adults and authority figures and things like that. It's a really important time for that.
Well, that is what is so upsetting about the figures that you cite, that African-American children, for example, represent about 18% of all preschoolers, but they make up, you say, 42% of those suspended and nearly half of those who are suspended not once, but multiple times. It seems that educational practices, disciplinary practices that have been going on for so long in K through 12 are actually making an imprint on preschoolers who have not even been socialized yet.
Absolutely, and that's the danger of it. It's important to say that suspending and expelling any child at this age, it's our first recommendation that we should absolutely not be doing this at this, particularly at this age. But the only group that's overrepresented in the data is African-American children. And knowing what we know about how Black children fare in K-12 and knowing what we know about the way Black children are criminalized, there's something like so profoundly just horrible about talking about the school-to-prison pipeline or criminalizing youth and then realizing that when we say youth, we're talking about four-year-olds. And so our recommendations are really aimed at the experience of Black children in early education, because we are, as we're expanding early childhood education, a lot of the gains of expanding early ed is that we can reduce some of the disparities that we see later on in kids' like educational experience. But it's not just about like the numbers as far as achievement. It's also about the experience of students in school, and that those two things are connected in a very important way. And if we're pushing children out as early as 3, 4, and 5, of course, we see some of the things we see in K-12.
And at the top of your recommendations is that suspensions and expulsions be prohibited in preschool. What kind of pushback have you been getting, or do you expect to get, from the recommendation for an absolute prohibition?
So we haven't received much prohibition, I suspect, because it's hard to defend that position, right? To be pro suspensions and expulsions for children at that age. But I think part of the reason why people have been supportive of our recommendations, because it's not just that we want to prohibit suspensions and expulsions and sort of leave teachers, schools, parents, and communities to sort of deal with whatever fallout. What we're saying is, like, absolutely, there are multiple things happening here. It's not just student behavior. It's not just teacher bias. It is all of these things rolled up into one. So in order to make that first recommendation a reality, it's important that you take all the other ones into account. So we have to change the way we train teachers. We have to change the way that we deal with children who are experiencing emotional trauma or trauma based on their home lives, all those things. There are other ways to deal with that that do not result in a child being removed from their school setting. And I think that's something that we wanted to emphasize, that it is possible. It's just that all of these other things that we know to work, all of these other suggestions that are evidence-based, should take the place of suspensions and expulsions, something we know to not work. It's not a sustainable remedy for anything that schools and teachers are trying to fix. And the things that we've suggested are things that are sustainable and are evidence-based.
A layperson would look at these kinds of figures, that half of those kids who are suspended or expelled multiple times are Black, and say this could be nothing but racism. After all, 3- and 4-year-olds aren't members of gangs, and they don't belong to cliques that have some kind of attitude towards authority. What else could it be but race?
Absolutely. I think that's a major part of the report. We also don't want to minimize the fact that there are a lot of other children who are suspended. A lot of the reported reasons behind that is misbehavior. And sort of even in the context of misbehavior, there's a lot of nuance there. So is it a situation where a teacher perceives something to be misbehavior because the child is Black? Absolutely. We think that's something that happens. But we also think that there are a lot of African-American children, just because of the numbers of African-American children that live in poverty, who do come to school with a lot of emotional and family trauma and do not have enough outlets for dealing with that. And so instead of being supported by their schools, they're being pushed back out of them. And that's why we want this to be talked about with nuance, that there are absolutely children who are experiencing racism and bias from their school environment. There are also children who are coming in with a lot of emotional trauma who are not being supported from their school. And I think we want everyone to be talking about all of these issues simultaneously.
Preschool hasn't been around all that long on a large scale. Has there been time to do long-term studies that have followed the kids who were or were not suspended or expelled when they were in preschool and see how they fare later on in their academic life?
Fewer of those longitudinal studies exist. We sort of know sort of the reverse has been done. So when students are suspended and expelled in K-12, often the survey question will be, were you suspended or expelled earlier? We know that children who are suspended or expelled in early education are more likely to be suspended or expelled later on in their educational career, and there's a lot of longitudinal research there. But the sort of identification of preschool suspension and expulsion at a nationwide level is fairly new in that context. The first nationwide expulsion study was done in 2005. The first data collection on a national level about preschool suspension was collected for the 2011-2012 school year and then reported for the first time in 2014 by the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights. So this conversation, this adding preschool to the school-to-prison pipeline conversation is relatively new, and so there's a lot more research to be done on what actually happens to kids at all levels based on this, but we do know a little bit about it, and what we do know is that it's not good.
Mariam Adamu of the Center for American Progress in Washington.
Activists in Newark, New Jersey, turned out for a forum organized to prepare for the installation of a new civilian complaint review board appointed by Mayor Raz Baraka. The Black-led People's Organization for Progress, POP, will be represented on the board along with other community groups. Larry Adams is vice chairman of POP. He says the review board must have the power to subpoena witnesses and police records.
If it can't look into the records of individuals, if it can't look into the records of the organization, then it's very difficult to provide oversight. And it's essentially what these bodies in other cities have floundered over. You have a body of people who can't get to the nitty-gritty of the organization or police who are brought before them. It is what gives the body strength and authority. Absolute authority would be if it had the authority to impose discipline on police that are found to be in violation of the law, the rules, abusive of their authority. And although we would love that, we don't have that. The imposition of discipline remains with the police director. But there is an advance that's made on this front, in that there is a matrix of discipline, ironically, a maximum, a mandatory minimums and maximums for various offenses that will be developed, a matrix of discipline. And the police director has to accept, unless there is a finding of blatant error on the part of the Civilian Complaint Review Board, the police director has to accept their findings and impose the discipline. If you find some egregious error on the part of the CCRB, then he does not have to impose the recommended discipline, but he is required to come before the board, give a written explanation, and orally defend differences between what the CCRB recommended and what he decided to do.
And what is the penalty for the police director if he refuses to do so?
If I remember correctly, one, since the police director and the CCRB are appointed by the mayor, there is appeal to the mayor.
So this is essentially the mayor's review board.
In fact, it is. I mean, it is in its origin. The CCRB comes into being by executive order, which is a step forward, but it's also a weak step forward. Because if Raz Baraka is not the mayor, the next mayor could dissolve the body by executive order. So that one of the political objectives that has to be taken up by supporters of civilian oversight of the police is to get the CCRB established by virtue of municipal ordinance, by the city council passing an ordinance that establishes the CCRB. The mayor has taken a step forward, and the police director, Venerable, both support the concept and support the executive order. But as I said, the body is vulnerable unless it's reinforced by municipal ordinance.
So let's say hypothetically that the city council does pass such an ordinance. What about the state? Can it interfere in the operations of the board? And what about the policemen's contracts? Union officials seem to take the position that the board should not be able to impose discipline on the police.
Well, technically, the board does not have the authority to impose discipline. It has the authority to recommend discipline. Imposition of discipline is by the police director, which is part and parcel of their contracts. Now, I'm not completely versed in provisions of the police contracts, but I think that, in fact, what we will see is political opposition probably coming from the police, probably supported by elements within the state government. But this oversight body and oversight process arises from the struggle of the masses of people of Newark and, in fact, across the country, of oppressed people across the country who strive for some way to control the police as resistance to oppression that's been imposed by the police. So that what will ultimately make it a success or not will be the degree to which we can mobilize mass political support for the oversight process. I mean, we're going to have to tweak it. There's going to have to be adjustments made. I have no doubt it's not a perfect document. The body as envisioned thus far is not a perfect body. I think, though, that it represents a step forward, and the struggle continues to improve it, and I think that the position is that this should be taken by progressive forces. What have the interest of the masses of people in heart and in mind is to defend this and enhance this.
It's hard to believe that Governor Chris Christie would remain quiet if a police review board such as Newark proposes actually did come down hard on the police. And the governor does have some leverage over the mayor.
Absolutely. That's why I don't think we can rely just on the mayor. The mayor needs to have the back of the movement in regarding this civilian police review board. The mayor has to be held accountable to the backs of the people. The governor has to be, to the degree we can, be held accountable to the masses of the people. I mean, he has already expressed, I believe, that there is no need for a civilian complaint review board. But he also announced that, you know, Black Lives Matter movement is responsible for and calls for shooting police. You know, he's no big fan. He's not a supporter. He constitutes part of the political opposition. Strength of defending this will be determined by the degree to which we can build a mass constituency to support it. And I think it's not only here, but also across the country. I think that the Newark model, as proposed thus far, is a weapon that can, if replicated, can be useful in the pushback against state terror, against the war on black people.
So you seem to be saying that these police review boards, if they are to be effective, can only come into existence through the pressures from the people and can only remain in existence through those kinds of pressures as well.
That's absolutely clear. That's exactly what I'm saying. Otherwise, it could be turned into its opposite of what it would, at least ostensibly, it's intended to be. It could be turned into a weapon in the hands of those who would abuse and who would foster state terror. But then it could have a stamp of approval by the so-called civilian oversight that this cop who throws a 16-year-old kid across the room, or this cop that strangled a brother using an illegal chokehold, or shoots him in the back, you know, 40 feet away, running away and claims to be defending himself, did no wrong. That not only then would you have police unions, not only then would you have grand juries who fail to bring back a true bill, you would then have a stamp of approval by the body that's supposed to protect and defend the interests of the masses. So we don't want it to turn into its opposite. We want it to be a voice of resistance, an instrument of defense for the masses of the people, and we've got to mobilize the constituents. I mean, there's a basis to start for that constituency with the community organizations who are from the get-go seated on the board, seven community organizations, of which we are one, POP, and four or five representatives of the city council who make up the Civilian Complaint Review Board. But ostensibly, each of those community organizations represents some constituencies. And it's incumbent upon all of us to mobilize our individual and collective constituencies and to reach out some more. We've got to build a constituency so that people know the existence of the CCRB and hopefully can get behind it and defend it.
That was Larry Adams of the People's Organization for Progress in Newark, New Jersey.
The nation of Haiti held a second round of elections on October 25th, this time for president. Back in August, legislative elections were marred by massive voter suppression by allies of the current government. The Boston-based Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti set up a hotline to report irregularities in both elections. The first tallies from October's presidential ballots should be released later this week. But Institute Director Brian Concannon says the U.S.-backed Haitian regime has tampered with that election, too.
It's widely reported, and at this point uncontroversial, that there were widespread irregularities and also a low turnout. In terms of the turnout, most estimates are somewhere between 20 and 30% turnout, usually towards the high end of that, and that is, by Haitian standards, kind of a catastrophically low turnout for a presidential election. And we think that that was produced by a bunch of factors, especially the fact that you had so much violence on August 9th that there was never any punishment for the people who did that. In terms of the elections on Sunday, though, there was much less violence. It was good. The police stepped up, which was good. In terms of just having voting centers open and getting material on time, those kinds of things were all much better, which is obviously good to have that kind of improvement. But the turnout is a huge problem. The other issue is that there is fairly widespread and uncontroverted reports of double voting or multiple voting by people, of political party representatives intimidating people who were voting or in other cases urging them who to vote for, which they're not supposed to be doing.
And what parties are generally responsible for that intimidation?
There's been blame spread around widely, but most of the times where anybody was able to identify the party was a party that was associated with the government, which is consistent with what happened on August 9th, where even the CEP reported that the parties that did the most violence on August 9th were the two parties connected to the president.
You say that a turnout of 20 to 30% is pretty catastrophic by Haitian standards, but Martelly was put in office in a vote with a turnout that was, I believe, less than that.
It was, and that was a catastrophe then that's turned into a five-year catastrophe. I think his first round election was maybe 24%. And the three elections before that were, just for, by comparison, were about 60% turnout. The 60% is probably the better baseline for what an appropriate turnout is. And when Martelly won in 2010, there wasn't the specter of violence. It was just that the Electoral Council had eliminated the candidates that people wanted to vote for. And so that was more of a boycott where people saw it was an unfair election and were trying to express an opinion about it by not showing up. I think this year it appears, because most parties were allowed to participate, there were some candidates who were excluded, and that I think that led to some voter dissuasion. But the main problem was violence.
Lavalasse was allowed to participate in some form in this election.
Yes, it was. And its presidential candidate was able to run and to campaign fairly freely. You know, in terms of the campaign, there's a couple parties that appeared to have a lot of money, you know, tons of posters, very apparently well-financed rallies, and two of those parties were government-associated parties, and the president's parties used government resources to get people to rallies and things like that. So it does appear there was an unfair financing playing field, and that Femi Lavalasse was a victim of that, or did not do as well as some of the other people in terms of getting government financing, but in terms of actually being able to campaign, Femi Lavalasse was able to campaign.
In terms of financing, this election was largely paid for by the United States Agency for International Development. Would they bear some responsibility for what happened in the election?
Oh, sure. And that's something we actually were writing about. I don't recall if they spent any or much money in terms of financing campaigns, but they financed a lot of the election infrastructure. And I think the U.S.
is responsible through its financing, but even on a broader plane, through its very persistent and non-critical support of the government, regardless of whether the government complied with the Constitution. And this goes back from the time where President Martelly was installed, basically because Secretary Clinton forced him onto the ballot for the second round, forced the Electoral Commission to reverse the results between the second and third place finishers. And throughout President Martelly's term, the U.S. has been strongly supportive. You know, even the outgoing ambassador just left last month, on her way out, made a lot of critical statements of people who were complaining about the August 9th elections. And these are people complaining about demonstrated problems. There's huge amounts of proof that these problems happened, and she was dismissing those complaints as people who were just trying to block the election. That's been the U.S. position for 3 years now, where every time the Haitian government tried to do something illegal to set up poor elections and people in Haiti would complain, the U.S. would then dismiss those people as trying to somehow slow down the process when they're really trying to make the process fair.
So the United States government facilitates an election in which there are reports of widespread irregularities and fingers pointed at the government that the United States supports.
That's a good way of putting it. And in a large part, and this was revealed in a U.S. Embassy cable back in 2010 that was released through WikiLeaks, where the ambassador talked about the Préval government, which again it was supporting, and admitted in this confidential cable that the Préval government was, quote, manipulating the elections, and recognizing that he was trying to manipulate it, concluded that the Préval government is more or less complying with U.S. requests, and that therefore the U.S. government needed to continue to support that government regardless of its compliance with fair election rules.
So the United States government facilitates elections that cables show it knows full well are rigged, and then, predictably, after the election, says that the elections were fair.
That's well said. Let me give you an inverse example. So back in 2000, when President Aristide was running for re-election, the United States said, before the election, kept saying, Lavalas can't win, it's not popular. During the election day, you had the Electoral Council had the official numbers, I think, were 63% turnout, some high level of turnout, with President Aristide winning a huge percentage of that. And the U.S. government dismissed the election day, said nope, said the turnout was extremely low and that it was highly corrupt. And then for years afterwards, continued to use the alleged flaws in the election as ways to undermine and to punish the Haitian government. There was a Gallup poll that was released, three Gallup polls, one taken before the election, one just after the election, and one a little bit beyond it. And they asked people before the elections who they were going to vote for, and the Gallup poll said that they were going to vote for Lavalas. So the U.S. knew that Lavalas was the most popular party, but was saying the exact opposite. After the elections, they asked people who they voted for, if they voted, and who they voted for. And a large percentage of the people wouldn't answer those questions, but of the people who did, it was like 63% said they did vote. So it was very close to, within a couple of percentage of points, the official results. And they asked who they voted for. Again, a high percentage, consistent with the official numbers, said they voted for Lavalas. So the U.S. knew from these polls that the elections were good. They knew who was going to win beforehand. They knew who had won afterwards. And they knew that it was broadly representative of Haitian voters' desires. And instead of using that poll to inform policy, they classified that poll so members of Congress couldn't even get it.
The United States classified a poll as if a poll was a danger to U.S. national security, a poll of Haitians.
A Gallup poll, they commissioned Gallup to do it, and it was information they wouldn't even give to members of Congress because it gave information contrary to the policy. So instead of using information to inform policy and make good policy, they kept information away from the policymaking process because they had a predetermined outcome. And the criteria really for U.S. supporting of Haitian governments is the willingness of Haitian governments to comply with policy requests by the United States. And if a government, and you've seen this, Préval's kind of left of center and Martelly is right of center, the U.S. has been very supportive of both, not because they support where they are on the spectrum, because both have been very willing to comply with requests from the United States government.
And what does this election augur in terms of the space that will be available, the political space on the ground afterwards for people who want fundamental social change in Haiti?
You know, it augurs poorly. The elections are obviously a great opportunity for people to engage with the government. And the fact that 7 out of 10 voters were either too afraid or otherwise dissuaded from voting means that they're not going to feel engaged with this government. There also means that they don't feel that they have a meaningful ability to engage with the government. And so I think the people are going to be dissuaded over the next 5 years. They're not going to believe this is their government. They're not going to think that typical civil society forms of engagement are going to work. And I think people are going to say they have to the extent they are going to try to influence government policy, it's going to be through fairly disruptive tactics, because I think most people are going to be convinced that's the only thing that will work.
The Haiti Action Committee, based in the San Francisco Bay Area, was part of a human rights and labor fact-finding delegation to the island nation. Haiti Action's Pierre Labassiere and his colleagues believe the turnout of voters was not low, but that the vote was suppressed by the ruling party. He disputes that only 20 to 30% of Haitians attempted to vote.
That I have a problem with, because though I wasn't underground, but I was monitoring what was happening, I'm being in contact with a number of grassroots organizations, because I do, in the course of the many decades of our involvement and working with Haiti, we have a number of contacts on the ground. I know there was a large turnout, and the turnout has to be defined. For example, if you are talking about the number of votes cast, now it was low, because what happened, there was voter suppression. And I kept getting reports consistently that as people went to the polls, many people were turned away from the polls. Tricks they were using, for example, on the outside of the voting centers. Number one, I'll have to, this was really, it's emerging now. What I heard when I was monitoring this by phone and talking to people, talking to brothers and sisters on the ground, was that people, as they were going to the polls, the voter walls on the outside of the voting centers would list their name. Once they went inside, their names would not be found. The voting center could have as many as maybe 20, 24, 15, some 10 polling stations. So each voting center, let's say it's housed in a building, a school, for example, and inside that voting center, you could have as many as 20, 24, 15, 40 polling stations. So outside, people would see their names on the voter rolls, but then when they went inside, they couldn't find their name at any of those polling stations. And they would tell them to go to some other polling station that could be miles away. Now, transportation costs a lot of money in Haiti. And for an impoverished majority, for an impoverished person, even though as determined as they are, some of them did go to another voting center. Some people went to three because they were determined to find to vote, but they still couldn't find their names anywhere. So if you are looking at the number of vote cast, yes, the turnout was low because there was great voter suppression. But if you're looking at turnout and the enthusiasm of the people as they were turning out, they reported massive crowds were out there, then, you know, clearly the turnout was high, but there was massive voter suppression.
And the lower success rate in terms of being able to vote would depend largely, therefore, on whether you were poor and didn't have the resources to go around shopping over miles for the right voting place, or whether you had the resources.
Definitely. I spoke to a woman, to an organizer, a community organizer, and she told me that she had been voting in Haiti ever since she was, ever since she became of age to vote. And the places that normally she would go were the polling places in her neighborhood. This time she couldn't find any place that was, so she had to go on the internet. Now, mind you, she had to go on the internet in order to find the right place finally for to vote. And then she had to vote with a provisional because she demanded her rights. Now, she said the majority of Haitians have no access to the internet. And you're talking about people who are very poor, no access to the internet. That's never been done before. So that takes us back to the way that this whole charade was carried out. For example, the availability of places, of polling stations, the number of people, particularly in the rural areas. I spoke to another, to a gentleman, who had a pickup truck who was giving people a ride to take them to vote. And he told me he was from the rural area. He said this was terrible. People had to go for miles in order to get to a voting center to vote. And when they got there, because they wanted to vote, and they wanted to vote, they had a clear purpose. And let me be frank about it, a number of them, great majority of people, were very energized to vote for Famille Lavalas, which is the party of President Aristide, which had been campaigning significantly, very strongly, along with a number of people, but it's the majority political party in Haiti, which after 15 years, that was the first time that people were participating in an election in which Famille Lavalas, the majority party where they, with which they identified themselves, they were eager to vote for that party or to turn out. And so he said that they would go, and then their name was not nowhere to be found, and they would not let them vote, even being given a provisional ballot. There was no such thing. So you see, that was the voter suppression. It was occurring throughout the process. And that was one of the things that happened in Haiti. And then another part I want to bring out about this, what I'm calling a charade, and which, by the way, I have to keep emphasizing, people expected that. It was very similar to brothers and sisters from the footage I've seen in the South during the voting when people were demanding their right to vote in the southern United States. Even though people knew all the questions, you know, those so-called tests that they would be imposing on people in order to deny them the right to vote and all the measures that they would come up with to suppress, to prevent them from voting. But yet people were determined to go and exercise their right because they felt it was a right that they had and they wouldn't let somebody take away, even against impossible odds. So it was the same spirit that I saw among the people of Haiti who kept going, who said, no, this time we are going to do it because this is the movement that we had fought for. Many of our people in Haiti had fought for the right to participate, had fought for the right to vote. Many of us have died for it. This is, we have a constitution that we, the people, voted overwhelmingly and massively for the constitution, which guarantees us the right to vote, which is our right to participate and have a say in the running of Haiti. And we are not going to let Michel Martelly, the current president, we are not going to let the UN, the U.S., France, Canada, who are occupying our country and plundering our resources, we're not going to let them turn us around. And that's the determination I saw 3 days before the elections, and that's what was occurring in different parts throughout Haiti on that day.
Now, let's note, of course, that the Famille Lavalas won elections by huge landslides all the way up until the United States-backed coup of 2004, after which Lavalas was not allowed to participate. So one would assume that Lavalas would have a residual base of support, which would be very significant still. I guess what you're saying is the lower the voter turnout, that is the successful voter rate due to repression, the bigger the advantage for the ruling party, Martelly's party.
Precisely. And one thing I can tell you that I saw, as we were going to the south, we ran into a caravan of the Famille Lavalas party. And the presidential candidate, Dr. Maris Narcisse, was in this caravan of cars that was on the road. And we were struck by how they stopped all along the way. Now, this is the rural areas of Haiti. They stopped all along the way in a marketplace in which I witnessed personally, and how the picture of President Aristide with Dr. Narcisse, and she's a medical doctor who has practiced a lot throughout her adult life and in Haiti, and how the people came to hug her. Crowds quickly formed around the car, and people were hugging and kissing the picture of President Aristide, and people were hugging her, the market women. So we saw a lot of this display of love, and we left on Thursday. We left Haiti on Thursday. By Friday, President Aristide went into the streets to campaign for Dr. Narcisse. He could not even leave his house because of the massive, massive turnout. Once people heard he was on the streets, people just mobbed him and Dr. Narcisse and saying, look, when Lavalas was there, the focus was on building homes, affordable housing for people, building schools, providing health care for the population, providing support for the peasantry who are engaged in producing food locally for the population. Even though there was a lot of economic sabotage by the so-called Friends of Haiti, the so-called international community, as they call themselves, but more was done in Haiti than had ever been done before from a government in terms of providing for the people and working it to implement the people's agenda. Typically, whenever politicians in Haiti, they'll say, well, we are for the people and this and that, but the agenda is never put together. There is never a national program put together by the people of Haiti. It was the party of Fermi Lavalas that really got together a national agenda, a program that the various communities had input in, and they published it in a book called Investir dans l'Humain, Investing in People. And when they were elected, I'm talking about Fermi Lavalas, they actually implemented the program that they had promised the people, that if elected, the people's agenda would be implemented. And you see, the people remember that. And yet people said, well, you guys have been there close to 12 years now. And when we compare the programs that were in place for our children, programs that were in place for us in terms of health care, subsidies for education, the sense of our national dignity, where all of us were working together to rebuild Haiti. Now, with all the money you guys have gotten from the world following the earthquake, all the monies that poured into Haiti that were denied to the people's government, but that the government of the elite and their international friends have received, the misery of the people of Haiti has never been worse. So people with that, people were empowered, people were enthusiastic, they knew who they were going to vote for, and that's what we found in Haiti. That was so profound and very clear from the masses of the people in Haiti.
Now, the tallies of the votes are not yet in, but you believe that because of this tremendous enthusiasm for Lavalas, that in the end, the party will still, despite the massive voter suppression, come out fairly well.
Yes, and the Fermi Lavalas party gave a press conference in which they denounced what has happened. The attorney for the party has called for the removal, has called that the CEP, the Provisional Electoral Council, needs to remove the presidential candidate, Jovenel Moïse, who is the candidate of Martelly's party. They have called for him to be disqualified because the fraud had occurred and their complicity in the fraud, their participation in the fraud. For example, one of the high-level employees of the National Palace of Martelly's government, it's claimed that he was the chief of protocol for the National Palace. He got into an accident on Monday in his car, and several boxes of ballots were found in the car. Now, that shouldn't have been in his possession at all. That and other incriminating evidence showing that there was high level of participation of the National Palace in the fraud that was occurring. Also, a number of people have come out on the radio, and these are election observers, election monitors, because different parties are entitled to have in their representatives present during the entire voting process and also during the count. But they have stated that they have kicked them out. For example, in Tabar, in the voting center of Tabar, where President Aristide lives and where there was a massive turnout, at some point the police came in and kicked everybody out. All the election observers and monitors, and they had a couple of ambulances there, and people said that it's being reported on the radio that a number of ballots, nobody could see that anybody had been injured or anything. The day was going very well with people turning out massively. Then this police operation took place with ambulances, and it's been reported that these ambulances were carrying ballots that were being used to substitute for the real votes of the people. But despite a lot of those reports that are coming out, that are being publicized about the fraud, but people in the Familia Balas Party believe very strongly that based on the outpouring of the massive turnout, it's sufficient to overcome a lot of these fraudulent practices that were being carried out.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.